The next case on the court's en banc oral argument calendar is Does 1 through 24 Individuals versus the 8th Judicial District Court et al. Case number 64890. Are you ready, Michelle?
May it please the court, Alina Schell on behalf of the petitioners in this case. At this time, I'm going to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. The stated intent of AB 579 is to help the state identify and monitor sexually dangerous individuals. And we acknowledge that's an important goal. That's something we all want. Unfortunately, AB 579 is not the right tool for doing this. AB 579 is a very blunt tool. It is a tool that treats virtually all offenders as sexually dangerous, regardless of their actual dangerousness, and regardless of the fact that our clients in particular, have rehabilitated. They've been out of the system. It's a blunt tool that forces people to be subjected to onerous and very humiliating registration notification requirements. And it destroys plea agreements, it undermines judicial decision-making, and it violates the separation of powers between the legislative and judicial branches. All of these very negative effects cause irreparable harm to our clients.
How do we overcome Logan D. and ACLU versus Basto? I mean,
well, first, Your Honor, with regard to Logan D., Logan D. dealt strictly with juvenile sex offenders, and that goes throughout the opinion. Last night I was looking on Google, and I ran a search of how many times juvenile sex offender was mentioned in that opinion, 98 times. It was limited to juvenile sex offenders who are quite different than adult sex offenders. Also, in this case, we're raising claims that are separate from ACLU versus Massa and Logan D. We're raising separation of powers and equal protection. Neither of those claims were raised in the prior litigation that's been before this court or that was before the Ninth Circuit. And another reason that it doesn't apply is because ACLU versus Masto is not a binding decision on this court. ACLU versus Masto is a federal decision, and this court has the power to interpret the state constitution more broadly than its federal counterpart. So let's address the issues that the prior litigation has not touched on yet.
Counsel, let me redirect you just a little bit before you get into your argument.
Okay.
We had originally, at least in the lower court, you had an application for a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction, which was later changed, and you got an order denying application of a temporary restraining order. And so you're before the court as to that outcome on a writ situation. And talk in terms of reasonable likelihood of success on the merits. Why did the lower court err? Why should we overturn what they did, looking at that standard in this situation?
Well, Your Honor, if I may step back a little bit from that question and say first that part of the issue in this case is that there has been no findings of fact made in this. There's been no factual discussion.
And that is one of my concerns, and that's why I said going back to the standard before the lower court, and the standard we have to consider is reasonable likelihood of success on the merits. That's a standard you theoretically have to get to for the court to grant you what you wanted down below. Why did the court care? Why did they make a mistake?
Well, because the court ignored some of the very strong constitutional claims in this case. Let's talk about the equal protection claim. As we've been looking at the facts and we've been talking to our does in this case, new facts have come to light which show that this statute violates equal protection. We have a client, a doe.
Are they a protected class?
He's an individual who's being treated differently than other individuals who have committed the same conduct. He was convicted of, and he has a Nevada conviction for the infamous crime against nature. He had sexual contact with a 16-year-old boy when he was an adult. That's no longer a crime in the state of Nevada. That was taken off the books. But under AB 579, even though that's not a crime anymore, because he has a sex offense conviction.
But was it a crime at the time?
It was a crime at the time. But now, someone who's committed the same crime, it's not even a crime now. So who commits the same act isn't even guilty of a crime. He's just, engaging in normal activity. As it regards the separation of powers doctrine, I think we have a very strong claim in that case. we have a strong claim with regard to that issue, because AB 579 is really usurping the judicial decision-making process of a sentencing court. Particularly, a lot of our does have Nevada convictions. A lot of our does pled guilty pursuant to a plea agreement.
But is it a sentencing determination, or is it a classification that the court doesn't involve itself in? If the legislature classifies an offense, do we have discretion in determining what that offender's classification would be, as opposed to a simple sentence?
Well, if AB 579 goes into effect, no. The court isn't going to have any kind of discretionary decision-making ability in that case. But with regard to retroactive offenders, I mean, let me start that answer over. So the way that sentencing works, as Your Honor knows, is that when someone commits a crime, they plead guilty, the court, the sentencing judge, makes a judicial determination about sexual dangerousness, what the appropriate sentence is, what the appropriate monitoring is, if they're required to register as a sex offender. So with a lot of our does who have Nevada cases, Nevada convictions, the judge has already made the decision about that. But what this AB 579 is going to do, if it applies retroactively to our clients, is it's going to substitute the decision-making process that the court engaged in with it's a one-size-fits-all approach to sentencing. And if you're trying to go after sexually dangerous people, that's not the way to do it. Because not all sex offenders, it's just like sex offenders aren't all the same person. One person might be dangerous, might have a risk of recidivism. Another person isn't going to. And when you take this incredibly broad brush approach to saying, you have that kind of offense, you're a tier one offender. You have that kind of offense, you're a tier two offender. That's not the way sentencing and registration should work. And we also have raised some other claims. If there are no further questions about that, I'm going to move on to some of our other claims. We've also raised some due process claims in this case. And I know it was 11th hour, but on, I believe it was Thursday or Friday, I filed a supplemental, a notice of supplemental authorities with this court regarding a vagueness issue with the statute itself. The problem with AB 579 is that it takes a very, as I've said before, one-size-fits-all approach to sentencing sex offenders. And part of the problem is the way that the AB 579 changes the definitions of what constitutes a sex offense in this case. Now, with NRS 179D.097, sex offense, what constitutes a sex offense is defined as, first, there's a list of enumerated offenses, and it specifically names certain crimes and offenses that are going to qualify as sex offenses for the purposes of registration and notification. But then it has this catch-all provision that's very similar to the provision of the Armed Career Criminal Act that the court in Johnson versus United States recently declared unconstitutional. What it says is, the catch-all says, any offense that has an element involving a sexual act or sexual conduct with another. It doesn't tell us what sexual act means. It doesn't define what sexual conduct means. And the problem is, when you have something that is that vague, that's that overbroad, defendants are not going to know whether their crime fits within a category of sexual conduct. And I predict that if the AB 579 goes into effect, you're going to see what happened in federal court systems when people were trying to fight over what constitutes a violent felony for the purposes of ACCA. You're going to have cases where someone comes in with a conviction from out of state. Does their conviction fit within 179D.097? Is this a sexual offense that qualifies? And that's, you know, it's unconstitutional. And the Johnson versus United States says you can't legislate that way. You can't be that vague. Another issue with regards to due process is that there's no procedural mechanism for challenging tier classifications. Once someone is classified as a sex offender, there's nothing within the statute that gives offenders an opportunity to say, no, my offense doesn't qualify. No, my offense is I shouldn't be classified as a tier two offender, and I shouldn't be subject to community notification.
Didn't we have a challenge by, I guess it was Doe number two?
Yes, well, Doe number two got lucky. It was just pure chance that he caught that mistake, and he wrote a letter.
But you said there was no ability to challenge. Did not Doe number two challenge?
He did contact DPS, Your Honor, and changed that. But for other offenders, they may not be in the position to be quite so lucky as he was. In prior arguments in the lower court, let me restart that answer. There used to be 179D.760, which was the procedural mechanism within the statute which allowed for offenders to challenge their tier designation by writing DPS. That's how our client got around it, because the old statutes are still in effect right now. But if AB 579 goes into effect, you're not going to have that same statutory procedural mechanism to challenge your designation. Instead, you're going to be stuck with the designation, and you may have to you may have to go up on a writ to the court. You may have to go up on a writ to Your Honors. And that's not the way. If you're going to impose registration and notification on people, there should be a mechanism for them to challenge it and to be able to correct the error before it becomes something that can't unring. And that's something that, you know, gets elided over quite a bit when we're considering this, is the community notification. Under AB 579, there's now going to be the state registry website. I mean, it already exists, but people are now going to be Tier 1, Tier 2, and Tier 3 offenders are all going to be listed on the community notification website. And what happens if there's an error in that case? Certainly, you can call DPS, you can correct it, you're not supposed to be on there. But the problem is with the internet. You can't unring the bell with the internet. Even if you get taken off the state registry, there's a possibility that there's a lot of private companies now that buy these, that go collect the state registry information, compile it, and have a privately available website where people can go on and look at for sex offenders in their neighborhood. If this statute goes into effect and there's an offender who's erroneously listed on the state website, even if he's taken off the state website, he could be on a private website forever. And the consequences of that can be devastating for individuals and their families.
You suggested at the beginning of your argument that the court could examine the Nevada Constitution and arrive at a conclusion that is different on some of these issues that have already been covered in the Masto case. Let's take this due process question as an example.
Okay.
What in the Nevada Constitution would you point to, either a section or its history or its decisional law, that would provide a basis for us to apply the Nevada Constitution and arrive at a due process violation in this statute?
No, Your Honor, I don't have a good example for you. If you'd like me to answer that, I could always submit supplemental briefing to the court to flesh that answer out. But just generally, the concept of federal and state constitutions being separate is a generally accepted concept in American society. The federal constitution certainly influences your decision making, but you have broad powers to enforce the state constitution as you see fit to protect your citizens. And I see I'm running down the clock. I'm sorry I don't have a better answer for you, Your Honor, but if you do want me to do briefing, I would be happy to do so.
Thank you. Ms. Buchanan?
Yes, good morning. May it please the court. Kimberly Buchanan on behalf of Real Parties in Interest. I'm here today respectfully requesting that this court affirm the district court's denial of the preliminary injunction by following the precedent that this court set in Ray Logan D and extended to the adult matter in the matter of SM. In the Does 1 through 24 matter, there were six causes of action that were asserted: equal protection, separation of powers, contracts clause, due process, ex post facto, and double jeopardy. And I believe it was Justice Hardesty who mentioned that all of these were raised in ACLU versus Masto, and that is in fact correct. In the opposition to the TRO, we actually did a comparison between the Does 1 through 24 complaint and ACLU versus Masto, and Does 1 through 24 complaint is virtually lifted from ACLU versus Masto. So separation of powers and equal protection, contrary to counsel, was in fact raised in ACLU versus Masto. And as Justice Hardesty indicated, this court in its analysis in Ray Logan D. extended the same constitutional framework in interpreting ex post facto due process that was the analysis that the Ninth Circuit did in ACLU versus Masto. So getting back to the standard of review in this case, a preliminary injunction at the district court level is available upon a showing of reasonable probability of success on the merits and irreparable harm absent the issuance of the stay. The district court held that there was not a reasonable probability of success on the merits. So what you've heard at the district court level and here today is an emphasis on irreparable harm and what will happen to the petitioners if this law were to go into effect. But what you really don't hear is a demonstration of a reasonable probability of success on the merits. And it is, in fact, a two-pronged test to be entitled to a preliminary injunction.
Let me ask you this. Your opposing counsel indicated that Logan D. is distinguishable because it only applies to juveniles. Should that be the case, and why shouldn't it be extended to adults?
Well, in fact, this court has already extended it to an adult setting in the matter of SM. Further, an examination of the In re Logan D. matter does not limit it to the juvenile context. An analysis in the ex post facto matter, for example, and whether or not the legislature's intent was to deem AB 579 civil, this court looked at AB 579 as a whole and didn't limit it just to the juvenile context. Now, I understand that in the dissent, the concern was in a juvenile context that Smith v. Doe couldn't be extended because there were concerns that the information concerning the offenders were not necessarily a matter of public record like they are in an adult setting. So to get over the hurdle of the constitutionality is much more difficult in the juvenile setting, and nonetheless, this court held AB 579 constitutional in the juvenile setting. And so we would request that it be extended to the adult matter, as you've done in the matter of SM.
If we deny the writ, there's still a possibility that they could go back and make a good record on a trial and then come back to us. Am I correct?
Well, Your Honor, they've denied that the law would be implemented, so...
I understand that.
Yes, I mean, I assume so, Your Honor, that the case could proceed forward, but one of the questions that this court asked me when I appeared in the matter of MW was whether discovery was necessary. And discovery is not necessary in this case. There's been much argument made by counsel that discovery is necessary, particularly in the previous case, because we need to establish a record below. This is a facial challenge to the statute. It's pre-enforcement. The law has not been enacted yet. Further, discovery tells us nothing in this case. What is there to discover? The statutes, part of the beauty of Adam Walsh Act, AB 579, is the fact that it's very clear on its face. You know that if you've committed, as an offender, rape, you're a Tier 3. It's very clear. You're not going to have to wait for the assessment process by DPS. And that's another matter I want to bring up to this court. The assertion was made that there was somehow a judicial determination in the state of Nevada as to an individual's risk of recidivism or dangerousness, and that's simply not the case. That is not done by the courts here in Nevada. That is done by the Department of Public Safety. And so turning to the argument of separation of powers, that is, in fact, properly before this court because it was raised in Does 1 through 24. But this court has previously said in the matter of Dolette that the purpose of the Sex Offender Registration Act is a civil regulatory scheme enacted for the protection of the public. Now, placing offenders into different tiering categories, requiring them to register in person or for longer periods of time, does not violate the separation of powers. The Ohio Supreme Court Boyke was unique to the Ohio Supreme Court, and many courts have rejected that analysis. Particularly, there's a case out of Nebraska where, like our case, the Nebraska Department of Public Safety actually did the risk assessment, and that's what we have currently under Megan's Law. Further, the judicial determination in Ohio did not purport to determine what we in the state of Nevada do to protect our citizens. It was determining the risk of dangerousness within its state. And this court in Donlin v. State has already ruled that the full faith and credit does not extend for matters of public policy. And in that case, the termination of a sex offender's duty to register in California California didn't result in the termination of this state. And the reason why is because Nevada gets to determine how to best protect its citizens. And I would assert that that's the same exact case in this matter. The state of Nevada, through AB 579, which the legislature enacted in its infinite wisdom, gets to determine how best to protect its citizens. Now, a lot of the arguments, both in briefing and orally here today, deal with policy considerations. And so if we're looking at a separation of powers argument, it is, in fact, petitioners who are looking at a purported separation of powers by asking this court to go beyond its judicial role and taking a policy determination as to what would be best. This court has already rejected that in Ray Logan D. and said it is not this court's job to determine what is the best legislative policy. While this court may disagree with the wisdom of the legislature, this court's job, due to separation of powers, is to determine whether the law is constitutional. And this court easily determined that AB 579 easily passes the rational basis test. And it passes the ex post facto challenge, as indicated in Ray Logan D. In terms of procedural due process, the procedural due process argument was decided in Ray Logan D. as well, and following the authority of Connecticut versus Department of Public Safety, saying they're not entitled to a hearing, and the reason they're not entitled to a hearing is because they can't prove any fact which is not relevant to the statutory scheme. The equal protection argument, AB 579, does not burden a fundamental right, again, going back to AB 579, that's not somehow unique in the juvenile context. There's no fundamental right. The right to privacy is not deemed by the United States Supreme Court to be fundamental, and thus it will be upheld if it's rationally related to a legitimate state purpose. And again, as this court indicated in Ray Logan D., there is a legitimate state purpose to protect the citizens from violent offenders, to protect our children, and to aid law enforcement, to keep track of these offenders. AB 579 now requires in-person verifications. The reason is that you get updated pictures of these offenders, so it's easier for tracking. Before one of these offenders goes off the rails and down the tracks for a year later, law enforcement is able to track them. If they're not coming in for their verification, an alert is sent out that this offender is not complying. So the in-person verification serves a very important purpose. The more frequent registration, again, serves that important purpose as well.
Do we have any precedent from other states or federal courts about knocking out sex offender registration and notification acts like AB 579? Where do we stand? Where do we stand in this country with sex registration?
Well, with sex registration, I would still say that Smith versus Doe is controlling authority, which holds that the law is constitutional. In terms of Ohio indicated that it was not permissible, that it violated ex post facto, but that would be unique to Ohio. Again, this court has already held that it does not violate ex post facto. That analysis, upon a review of In re Logan D., extended to an analysis of AB 579. AB 579, this court indicated, was enacted to be in compliance with the Adam Walsh Act and to receive federal funding, which is clearly civil in nature, and then an examination of the 7 Mendoza-Martina factors also weighs in favor, the strongest factor being that it's rationally related to an important governmental interest.
Now, the denial of federal funds is not actionable anymore. In other words, if you don't adopt the Adam Walsh Act, you can't deny somebody federal funds. I mean, that's what, when we originally did Logan D., that was the issue there.
Correct. And then we went in front of the legislature recently, and the legislature still went forward with Adam Walsh. They were looking at some additional tweaks, but when, of course, SB 99 went up to the governor's office, that's where it got vetoed, unfortunately. But I was proud of both the defense bar and plaintiff's bar that we all worked together to try and craft something that met everybody's needs, but unfortunately that didn't pass. So... the court's indulgence for a second. Getting back to the 7 Mendoza-Martinez factors, whether the sanction has been historically regarded as a punishment. Sex offender registration and notification statutes are a fairly recent origin, and this court indicated in Smith v. Doe, it's not akin to a historical punishment. They acknowledge the fact that while you have this broad base, you've got the internet now, and of course information spreads far and wide. However, that's not an integral part of the system. This is a civil regulatory system, and that any public shame or anything along those lines are but a collateral consequence of the criminal conviction. And again, that takes care of the dissent's concern, because this is all of these individuals are in a adult context. With respect to the late supplement, which what I would assert would be should be stricken, it was untimely and beyond the scope of the court's order. It cites a case that wasn't cited in the amicus brief, and this court's order gave petitioners an opportunity to file a supplement. We, of course, were deprived of the opportunity to respond to that, given the fact that it was filed at 11 a.m. on Friday morning. Nonetheless, I would say that that case is distinguishable in that it deals with an increased sentence penalty pursuant to ACCA. I would also assert that the void for vagueness was not raised in the Does 1 through 24 complaint. There was an assertion in the statement of facts concerning the catch-all provision, but it was not within the causes of action. The procedural due process, if you review Does 1 through 24, deals with what was asserted here, which is we don't have the opportunity to challenge this.
Well, wouldn't you like us to decide the issue of void for vagueness?
Certainly, Your
Otherwise,
Honor.
Otherwise, you guys all be back.
I beg your pardon?
You'd be back if you don't decide.
I've got a gazillion of these cases waiting, staying for a decision from this court, so I have a feeling I'll be back again. But nonetheless, Your Honor, 179D097, subsection P, is the catch-all provision, and it indicates that any other offense that has an element involving a sexual act or sexual conduct with another. All of the crimes that are deemed sexual acts are contained within chapters 200 and 201 of NRS. 201.263 defines sexual conduct in detail. Sexual conduct means acts of masturbation, homosexuality, sexual intercourse, or physical contact with a person's unclosed genitals or pubic area. Pretty straightforward definition. Additionally, the federal guidelines also define sexual act in their guidelines for so DPS can follow that. This is not a mystery. I would also assert that all of the petitioners in this case fall within a defined crime. None of them fall within the catch-all provision, and therefore they don't have standing to assert this. They're making a generic assertion, but Village of Hoffman Estates versus Flipside, the United States Supreme Court, 455 U.S. 489, indicates that plaintiffs must demonstrate that the statute is impermissibly vague in all of its applications. Again, as long as there's ordinarily understood meanings for the words employed, or in our case, actual statutory definitions, and within the guidelines provided by SORNA, there's additional definitions to determine what a sexual act is, then we certainly do not run afoul of the void for vagueness.
Counsel, we have an order from Judge Smith as to this matter, order denying application, and he indicates the court finds that AB 579 has been reviewed by both the Nevada Supreme Court, the Ninth Circuit, and both have been held. Both held AB 579 to be constitutional. The court further finds that the plaintiffs have not established a reasonable probability of success on the merits. Now, therefore, I guess my question is that a correct statement? And additionally, did the court have an obligation to at least state that there was no irreparable harm, possibility of irreparable harm? Making this ruling?
Again, Your Honor, it's a two-pronged test. It is a correct statement to say that the Ninth Circuit in ACLU versus Masto deemed it to be constitutional. And again, this court, in the findings of the challenges for ex post facto, did not limit it to the juvenile matter and did a wholesale analysis, thankfully for me, on the constitutionality of AB 579 in terms of ex post facto. So I believe it to be a correct statement because ex post facto was the largest challenge that was made at the district court level.
But this case attempts to broaden their challenge.
Beyond ACLU versus Masto.
Well, you said this court ruled as to ex post facto only. And so you were bootstrapping in. And I'm saying their challenge is a little bit broader.
Well, this court ruled, if I may, I think I'm out of time. Okay. This court ruled on procedural due process. That would not change in an adult context. Again, they are unable to prove a fact that's not of consequence to the regulatory system. So this court ruled on ex post facto procedural due process. There was a footnote also knocking out the equal protection claim in Ray Logan D. The only thing really that would be left would be the separation of powers argument. And in ACLU versus MASTO, the contracts claim that separation of powers was in fact asserted and decided. And again, if you look at the analysis that this court did in Ray Logan D, the constitutional decisions, it was predicated, it used the same constitutional analysis that the Ninth Circuit did.
On the contract claims issue, don't we have to look at some points, whether it's possible because individual defendants may have something that's specifically asserted in the plea agreement, opposed just to general plea agreement?
If there was an explicit, as the Ninth Circuit indicated in ACLU versus MASTO, if there was an explicit promise that was made to a defendant, that certainly could be enforced against the state. We freely acknowledge that. But that's not been any of the assertions in any of the complaints that have come before this court to date. So if that's a scenario that comes down the road, we'll certainly take a look at it at that point. But none of the plaintiffs here have asserted that. They've made the generic statements that were made in the Ninth Circuit, which was, well, it violates our plea agreement because we pled to this crime and we thought that it would end up being in a Tier 1, Tier 2, Tier 3. Frankly, at the time plea agreements are made, you don't know what tier you're going to be because, again, that's not a judicial determination. That is then done through a risk assessment tool through DPS. For those reasons, we would respectfully request that you affirm the district court's denial. Thank you.
Okay.
Your Honors, I just have two very brief points in my rebuttal. The first is I'd like to correct a representation by the state regarding the issues that were decided in MASTO. Certainly in the lower court, in the federal district court, the parties there did raise equal protection and separation of powers, but those were not raised before the Ninth Circuit. The Ninth Circuit opinion does not address those two claims. Therefore, they're still viable claims for the purposes of this court's determination. The other thing I'd like to talk about is I'd like to answer a question that Judge Cherry asked opposing counsel about where we stand with regard to other states in terms of the ex post facto finding. And the answer is, Your Honor, we stand alone, and not in a good way. Let me just go over the list. I brought it up with me, so forgive me for reading. Maryland, in 2013, Doe versus Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services found it violated the ex post facto clause. Wallace versus State in Indiana, ex post facto violation. State versus, forgive me for this, Latalian, Maine, 2009, ex post facto violation. State versus Williams, Ohio, 2011, ex post facto violation. And then finally, Doe versus State, Alaska, 2008, which is actually the predecessor case of Smith versus Doe, the Supreme Court case. So the answer is, Your Honor, we stand alone, and we shouldn't. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning. My name is Paul Godet. I'm appearing for Frank Kremen, who apologizes he's out of the country today on behalf of Michael Segelstein, the intervener in this case. As I said, I'll be very, very brief. Mr. Segelstein has been deprived the benefit of AB 579 in the amendment to the statute, and his position is this is a matter of constitutional application, not constitutionality of the statute itself, and I think that speaks for itself, because if you look today, you have certain previously convicted people who are here arguing regarding the constitutionality of the statute. You have Mr. Segelstein here today, previously convicted, arguing that he should be given the benefit of the statute. With that being said, the rest of the position is set forth in the brief.
All right. The case will stand submitted. Thank you to counsel for your briefing on this matter and your arguments here today.